Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we have Bonita Roy for the second time in the show. She is an author, philosopher, and teacher who's focused on building greater capacities for human sense-making. She's always very well tuned into what's going on in the world, and today we have a lot to talk to her about. We start by talking about the written piece she's working on human flourishing.
We also talk about the current social shift from global to local, what kinds of institutions we need right now, and how to engage in conversation about culture, race, and different expressions. To get all the links and show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/125, and to get access to the full 90-minute interview, you can become a member at futurethinkers.org/members.
Maybe I can start talking about what I'm actually doing and towards human flourishing. Basically, the bulk of what I'm doing right now is an educational approach. So I'm writing a large piece on a transformational philosophy of education, which kind of reassesses what education is for. It diminishes or it problematizes developmental psychology, because we tend to like see the child and see this path that they have to get developed through these paths and become systemic thinkers. And I am looking at that as accurate science, that it accurately represents the way our minds have been taught, but it doesn't accurately represent the full potential of the human mind. You know, I think it's much more reflective of the structures, the systems, and the way we institutionally educate people. And so the fact that the mind grows in a certain type of complexity through these stages is not so much a property of the mind. Obviously, the mind has the potential for that, but a property of the way the mind has been conditioned and educated to. So it starts with kind of trying to move away from that. And it's very difficult because we start to then discover these really strong assumptions in the modern mind, the Western mind. I'm going to say modern, but I don't mean like versus postmodern, but just contemporary Western culture. And that is, we have this whole mental model that's like a line from the past to the future. So that's also a developmental schema. And the past is primitive and the future represents advance. It's very hard for us to get outside of this mindset. So we discount the present because there's always something better in the future. This is like, in writing this book, it's really hard for me to find the actual language because this model is so ingrained in us, this model of linear time, and that the past is primitive and the future represents progress. So we get into all kinds of tautologies, like because we're on that path, we escalate complexity. There's reasons for that, but so we continue to escalate complexity, and then we conflate complexity with progress. So it's a reinforcing loop, and then we get things more and more complex, all right? So there's a lot of what is going on in current events and in all these spaces that is a product of this structural composition of the modern mind, the way we kind of it has a lot to do with, we have a single theory of change, for example. Well, there's two factors. One is there's always chasing the future. So that's one part of it. Like I think it's an obstacle to true human flourishing because we race over the fundamental potentials of what I call the core self. By, like, for example, by 3 years old, we assume kids, you know, or let's say 8 years old. They can, their body works, their perception works, their pretty much speech is on the way. And then we start downloading information as if the core self, the core sensory motor perceptual self, doesn't itself need to grow along the life path. So this is why, for example, in my course, I meet 30 and 40 and 50 year old people who have to revisit early childhood experience, revisit some fundamental primary schema, because that's what we do in our society. We move on to information download and we never teach to the core self after a certain age because we have this age stage kind of thing. And then I think the third aspect, just to give you some sense of how this is laying out. So I talk about transformational theory of change, where there's the core self. It has non-egoic evolutionary potentials. And then at a certain stage, it metamorphosizes into the core self plus the communal self. So, but it's like a building. If you're going to add the communal self onto the core self, then the foundation has to expand also. And then there's the cosmopolitan self. And then there's the psychedelic or creative self. So education as providing, scaffolding, leading the unfolding potential of these different selves. And then the third point, so we have problematizing development and progress. We have this notion of teaching to the selves, which are potentials. And then the third thing that's part of this human flourishing, I mean, it's a big project, is that we don't seem to be able to escape the Darwinian attitude. And that is, we're always, when we do systems thinking, what's always in the mix, what's always lurking, is that we have to adapt to something. We're always adapting to some threat or some systemic complexity. So complex adaptive thinking is also very hard to think out of the box. And there's some new literature on what systems thinking in the Anthropocene is. That we're always adapting to problems, and this actually escalates the problem within the problem. So we problematize nature, like we fight climate change, we fight this, we have to fight sea level rise, the way we work with COVID. So this seems to be the third limiting epistemic structure that's preventing us to move from modernity. They worked for us for a while, but how can we really look at human flourishing outside of those kind of traps? And I say, you know, between the progress in the future is like the carrot that's forever unreachable, and the Darwinian attitude is like the stick always threatening to strike. And that's what I say, that's actually how we've placed ourselves in the modern world. And that kind of is the framing. And then the question is, what are alternative ways, theories of change, alternative ways of thinking about education, alternative ways of thinking about the composition of the self? What's entering that space that might be interesting that we can draw on? And we're fortunate to have a lot of real talent thinking about this. And so I try to draw on some of what's in the literature already and some ideas that I have. So that's the big picture. And I think it's revealing things that are intuitive to people like yourself anyways. But hopefully it helps like us think, because if we have this intuition and then we're talking about Darwinian attitude and we get in this reactive responsive mode, then our conceptual tools are at odds with the emergent knowing and trying to kind of match them up better.
I'd love to look for specific examples to kind of ground this in current events with the race protests and riots and COVID and what's happening in the world right now. I think it'd be helpful to kind of find roots and symptoms out there in the real world.
Yeah, okay. So let's look at COVID first. There's the modern attitude is that this is something we can solve if, you know, like there's a lot of, everybody knows it's complex, that it's multidimensional, that has cascade effects, but there's an impression that sophisticated data can solve it. And in the future, there won't be coronavirus, right? In the future, there won't be coronavirus. That's an interesting proposition or hypothesis. We're so hooked on it that we don't even ask simple questions. If you go into the corona conversation and you ask a simple question, it's viewed as being too simplistic for this big project, systemic complexity project we're doing. So like a simple question if you have a vaccine and it works, then why do you need to have the vaccine every year? Does it actually make coronavirus go away if you have to be vaccinated every year? So what's the definition of a vaccine? Here's another question. If 85% of the people test positive for coronavirus and they're asymptomatic, does that mean they're sick? If people are asymptomatic to coronavirus, which means their immune system is working, why do they need a vaccine? If you get a vaccine, then why do you need other people to get a vaccine? Aren't you immune? These are simple questions, and you'll get complex, convoluted answers, but nobody answers the question. There's a alternative to answering these questions, which will seem very primitive, like something out of the past. It's not in the brave new world of solving these things at a massive scale. So then we can say, well, what's another way to look at this? So let's look at collective intelligence. Now, people think collective intelligence, or they wouldn't say this, but there's a way in which we respond to the COVID information ecology as if all this, that we're collecting all this intelligence, so that we can find the answer, right? And that is, and so it's very interesting. I actually love COVID because it just shows like, even the people doing running the data, it's all interpretation driven. There's people on Twitter who have found massive mistakes by the scientific work, you know, all this stuff. So there's an impression that given enough information ecology, then we should come, that should converge into the answer, right? And that's kind of like a developmental, like there's a prize at the end of, you know, if you get complex enough, there's a prize. But that's not what self-organizing collective intelligence is. Self-organizing collective intelligence is a collective version of your human brain. And the human brain has many micro states happening at the same time. Like when you go to choose, is it going to be chicken or, you know, chicken or whatever, or turkey. There's a little micro state in you going toward chicken, and there's a little micro state going to turkey. And it gets adjudicated in the body, right? It's kind of like when you think of a person playing tennis and they're receiving a serve. It's better to move in the wrong direction than to not move at all. You want movement. You want all this. There's always low threshold activity going on. And this is why we can through certain types of guiding psychology, we can go in and find, oh, I feel that way, and I feel that way, and I feel that way. Because when you go looking, you surface it to threshold level. So this is how collective intelligence works. You want experiments in Texas and Georgia that are not the same as New York, and you want anecdotes to come in, and you want people to kind of push back on the rules and see where they could get to, and then you want a certain amount of people being conservative. You want a lot of things going on at the same time because it represents the actions of the collective. If, for example, everybody took a hard stand, everybody in the U.S. took a hard stand, the coronavirus would be under one kind of selection pressure. And it would have to have been the one you bet all your pickles on. No, for something like coronavirus, you want it to be under many kinds of selection pressure. And this is not what big data does. It's what the human system does. So the humans that are like getting pissed off, like, I don't want to be in my room again because no one I know has coronavirus and my sister's hospital doesn't have it. They should be walking out. They should sense into their local environment. And if you're in a nursing home, you should sense that something's like really wrong, that they threw us in this nursing home and they let the so the local context that's sensed either anecdotally, I mean, we're not talking about, there's also bots creating lies and stuff like that, but just but that's going to sound very primitive. Well, we can't just let people like feel into their local environment because it's parochial. It's not the systemic view. But that's not understanding collective intelligence. And if you look at the information ecology from what I'm saying, it's actually working pretty well. It's actually putting pressure on people who like are shut down and scared, giving them as soon as they can have an advantage, they'll walk out because some of that other information's in their subthreshold consciousness. You want all this information operating all the time. And that creates like the species flourishes that way. And so there's this incredible grasping toward a kind of analysis, a kind of mind, a kind of systems thinking that is completely inadequate to these realities. But we're so hooked on like this convergent complexity as being progress and more sophisticated and more effective that we can't seem, even people in my own information space that have been talking about SOCI, SOCI, self-organized collective intelligence, have fallen into this trap. So there's a lot to be, so how can you trust distributed responses to a global event? So there's part of that. It doesn't map completely onto how I started, but there's something in that that has to do with the kind of thinking we're chasing, the kind of thinking we think is at the top of the stack for education that is actually obsolete now.
It seems like what you're saying is that there isn't one perfect final answer for some of these problems. And it's not a one-size-fits-all answer that is always applicable to all people at all times. There's no such thing.
And even by our own logics of how things mutate and stuff like that, that the one-size-fits-all is in the wrong direction, even by our own understanding of how these things work. It's not like, you have to let everyone do an experiment so some people take the hit. It's like, no, eventually you take less of a hit over time. You know, if you work with the level of complexity that a virus is. And that's just taking what we believe about the virus for face value. You know, there's a lot of complexity behind the media itself. Which we might not get into, but it's very similar. I can tag it onto something interesting that happened the other day, which I think is cool, and that is Trump and some people have the impression that the U.S. military supervenes on the states' rights, right? So he said, well, if you can't get it, governors, he told the governors, if you can't get it done, then I'll get it done. But that's not actually what the military is. The military is in service to the request of the governors. That's the only time the military can be brought in to a country. It doesn't exist in the U.S. as a unit. It's not its own unit in the U.S. It's only its own force and foreign policy, which is the purview of the commander-in-chief. And so somehow that's, I know it's a stretch, but it's the same thing. We think that the states somehow converge onto the top level power, which is the military, and it doesn't. And so what's cool is not only are generals articulating that truth, but the governors are now starting to send back the National Guards that have come from other states into their state, because again, it's context dependent. And you could take, if you take a cultural kind of spiral dynamics or developmental lens, you're going to say, oh, those states, they're conservative and an old structure and they're stupid. And these states are like liberal and scientifically informed. And, you know, but that's not a good lens for distributed intelligence. You know, Ricardo Semler said, never, if you're going to solve a societal problem, never ask just smart people into the room. If you have 20% derelicts, you invite 20% derelicts. And if you have 5% alcoholics, you invite 5%, because that's how it works. You know, that's truly what I call not complex adaptive, but complex potential systems thinking. You want as much potential in the state at every node. You don't want the system to adapt unilaterally. Dave Snowden calls it coherent heterogeneity. So these are new ideas, actually, that are getting traction. We get to watch them emerge in real time. It's kind of cool.
Do you feel, with some of these ideas put into the right or wrong context, I suppose, you could generate some angst and fire around this, especially when you bring it into the race context. Do you feel pressure to kind of fit into the uniform way of thinking when it comes to these issues? And this seems to be very counter to what you've already been talking about, this like information ecology immune system, where we have multiple different kind of ideas and diversity of thought spread out all over the world. And I felt pressure to kind of have one constrained narrow band of thinking, and I'm not allowed to talk about anything outside of that. So
to be on message, you know.
Yeah, I got to be on point, or it's
No, it's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought it up, because during this whole thing, I don't know, was it been 3 months, 2 months, 4 months, 75 days, I would notice the different spaces that I would go in. So let's say it was an online meeting. Oh, my cohort, that's the first time I noticed it. We did a module on genuine happiness, creativity, and flow in the middle of the COVID nightmare. And the question was, I could feel like, am I the teacher representing to the school? And we could all feel that there was sanctioning going on. We got over it by the third day. But then we actually talked a lot about what is that goes on? Like everybody's trying to feel, what are the implicit rules here? It certainly became a big deal on my Facebook page, because I called some people who are known in this space as being against social sanctioning of information as subtly social sanctioning. And then, of course, it got all very interesting. But I noticed that COVID had the power to really break some of the rules, even in that community that hates social sanctioning. And again, it was all across the board. And I think people kind of settled around a kind of wobble around a common understanding. But things like the question of whether COVID came out of the laboratory or not. We don't have to ask whether it's, you know, intentional. That was really highly taboo to talk about. It's recently has a lot of interesting investigation going on it. It's probably not black and white. What I'd like to see coming out of that is that this whole approach to studying viruses is in fact a technology that accelerates the mutation of them into human transmissible. So there's a very ethical question. It's one of these funny things that people do. Their very approach to trying to fix something is the thing that self-fulfills their prophecy. And it's clear that if you are suspicious that this virus that's in animals is going to mutate someday, it's bad enough that you then concentrate animals and in feedlots where it can mutate, but then you take laboratory rats or something and or bats and you keep taking the blood of one into the other, you know, and you keep doing this so you can be ahead of the mutation. There's something that's highly bizarre about that. But it's the kind of thing we do all the time.
So, like, to simplify what you're saying is that by trying to solve the problem in this way, we're actually making it worse and often creating more problems. It's like the Hydra.
Yes, it's also something interesting. The response and the problem grow together. And this is very similar to the riots. And although there's some cool stuff going on, there's some really, when I think about, I was thinking about it today, this society has grown much more sophisticated than in the late 50s and early 60s, when the civil rights movement, you know, the violence in the civil rights movement. First of all, there was very little way to know what was going on, and what was going on was just black and white. I mean, not in terms of race, but just like the governors, you know, they would just kill black people and white people who were civil rights workers. You know, during Kent State, they went and just shot citizens, you know, the mayor, I think it was Detroit, dropped a bomb on one of his buildings once. You know, the amount of force that was uncontested back then was huge. It was just, so there's really cool things that the police are doing now. Some of them seem silly, some of them are ritual, but, you know, to take a knee with the protesters, to be swift in judgment on the cops for George Floyd. I heard today that the mayor or the governor of Washington, D.C., I don't know if they have mayors or governor, it's a funny thing. He along like Main Street, he had them paint Black Lives Matter, he's sending home all the National Guard. This turn toward de-escalation is in the other direction of that mind I just told you about, right? So, yeah, there's some cool things going on. A lot of interesting videos from mostly Black women who are local to the problem that are trying to voice it's more complex than you think. Looters come into Black neighborhoods and destroy their neighborhood. And so I think that, I know it's painful to watch and people don't have that perspective, but I could be remembering the 50s and 60s wrong, but I have some experience in that area. When I lived in San Francisco, we used to host the Zimbabwean Liberation Army when they'd have their conferences in Oakland down at the Communist Center, and they'd all walk around with walkie-talkies and guns. And we're all paranoid and stuff, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not on the front end now, but I do see some interesting behaviors that you would not have seen then.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
It's interesting when you mention about the way that you're seeing these kinds of emergent responses to what is viewed as the problem that is not like this, you know, like, oh, we have to solve this, but it actually validates what people are expressing. And mm-hmm. I think I've noticed, and this is actually something that you brought up, Mike, that
yesterday.
Yeah. That a lot of the time there's this built up pressure and people just want to be heard. They want to be heard and acknowledged, like, this is my experience. You don't know what it's like. Just listen to me.
Yeah, that is a clear change for me, watching what's going on as far as events related to race. It's like, this is one of the first times I've ever felt like it seems like the entire world's giving this platform now. Like, everyone's kind of on the same page about, let's talk about this now. And some of the solutions I've heard proposed over the last several years, I've kind of shaken my head. It to me, it seemed like that narrowing of that bandwidth of thought. And just recently I realized, like, what we, in our group calls and on our members area, we always kind of unpack trauma, individual and collective. And so we kind of use a circling technique. Mm-hmm. And so we'll sit there, and even though you feel something kind of bubble up in yourself, as in response, you want to help or give advice or stop something, you stop yourself and let the thing be expressed. And most of the time when the thing is expressed, it's actually undone just in its expression. And I realize the same thing is happening collectively right now. And that for me to like want to jump in and say that solution's wrong, this solution's wrong, or this one's right is inappropriate. It's better to just kind of let the fire burn out on its own, and then we can start proposing solutions. But nothing needs to happen now.
And the thing is, there's something interesting in that, because when you're in the presence of that energy and it's given full permission to express itself, okay, so there's a release of energy on that side, but it changes you. Mm-hmm. It's a micro state. It, you know, and so these all adds up into potentials that change the world. So it's not like there's nothing happened on the other end. A little bit of shift is happening that turns into a big shift. But if you try to converge those two quickly, then you get the complex adaptive response. You get the push and the pushback, and then it escalates complexity. So I think, and that's how we understand, like, we, and of course, as I started, we think that complexity is a resolution, right? In that definition of complexity, there's other definitions of complexity. Arnie Nass said nature is the most complex thing on the planet, but when you walk through the forest, it's not complex like racial tension, right? So, but we tend to increase that kind of complexity. We push it down the line toward a bigger project. We make the problem bigger. We don't make it go away.
Yeah, the subject of stigmergy has come up a lot in recent years, the organizational principles that ants and bees use. And when I was a kid, I was really into learning about ants. And I always had this idea that it was the queen in some sort of command and control relationship with the drones. And, you know, when I learned about this stigmergic phenomenon, I understood that it's the agents kind of having a set kind of call and response with the environment they find mm-hmm. themselves in, and in a sophisticated level of communication cell to cell or unit to unit. And I recognize that in society, it's not what we're doing. We keep going to the kind of queen top down or bottom up, you know, one directional thing instead of the networked approach. Mm-hmm. We're all sovereign, resilient cells communicating our experiences to each other in a local environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I would put it this way. I mean, the workers love the queen. That's why it works. You know, it's really embodied. You know, I mean, obviously it's a simpler form, but yeah, the hierarchical thing is interesting, because the theory is that when people don't feel safe, they look for strong hierarchies or authoritarianism. It's an interesting hypothesis, because I think that's true up to a certain threshold, and then after which Carl Weick has done some work on this, after which the group, the collective, will fall apart and new types of relationships happen. And what is the collective that's based on kind of working identities falls apart, and people pair up with others that they have more of this intimate relationship with. So the collective goes down to a simpler but more powerful and not primitive form of relating. But we would tend to see that as a fault, right? So if a country starts to decentralize and people go back into strong local communities based on family, we would see that technically our theories call them old structures. You know, we see it as regressive. I think that we don't necessarily have to see it that way. And I obviously, this is in the instinct of a lot of young people. This move that is in a different direction.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of talk about localism, how globalism is breaking down, and now is the new era of localism. People are focusing a lot more on their family and their immediate communities or bioregions. It's interesting, and I think it feels really necessary, because it feels like that level of society or relationship has really been eroding for decades. Mm-hmm. And now all this vitality is coming back to it, and it's being regenerated and rebuilt.
Mm-hmm. So in my education, that's the requirement to develop the core self. You have to be somebody. You have to be from some place, right? In order to then take that someplace into the community. Right, you take your someplace to every place. And so that's the communal self. The cosmopolitan self is the self that has skills that are no place, you know, like skills like coding. They're truly cosmopolitan. They're not associated with place. So I think that all of these selves, they don't require just teaching. They require someone to help unfold the potential of that. Someone, and when I mean someone, not only teachers, but their lived experience has to reflect back that's what the core self is. You know, it's cool to talk every day about how important family is and live in a kind of household where nobody's ever home, and you basically are in institutions from the age of 3 to forever, you know? So I think this is one of the hard parts of the transmission, is that the transformation is that we've kind of skipped We don't have this, like, people don't know how to cook because we've had this kind of like big hole. And correct me if I'm wrong, because this is an idea that I read somewhere about the Soviet Union and the problem they had, like, mothers didn't raise their children. It was mostly institutionalized. And then after the fall of the Soviet Union, they had to have like these workshops to help people understand. Like, there was this whole gap between this like transmission of maternal care to maternal care, you know. It might be a myth, but
I'm not sure, to be honest. I'm not familiar with that. I can only speak to my own experience, and I definitely had this experience of, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so I got both at-home care, but I also got really pushed into all the different institutions and courses and classes. And I'm still dealing with that, because my relationship to authority and my relationship to structures is that of like, oh, institution, and I'm within an institution.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get out of that thinking.
Yeah.
Now thinking about that, actually, I really wonder about these protests that are happening, because a lot of them, the problem that they're bringing up is about institutions and institutionalized patterns of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the problem is because it's institutionalized. It's not human relating to human, it's authority relating to human.
Yeah, or even bureaucratic kind of institutions, you know. It's the whole bet on institutional performance that is problematic. One size fits all, you know. Institutions are great big huge things, so we're not talking about the institution that is the bread store or something, you know. We're talking about huge systems that, you know, the funny thing about institutional life, and it's going to tag with your aunt story, but in a funny way, is that people can enter an institution, do very little, like have a bullshit job, and the effects are very powerful. This is a built and inherent risk with institutions, because there's no heart. There's no heart or mind there in many cases. Things are just on automatic. And I think one of the things about the COVID is that we've all been, we have to stay away from our institutions, and people are starting, it doesn't take much to start to see how constructed they are, or how irrelevant they are to what matters to a human being, you know? And so that's an interesting phenomenon. What's the alternative to institutions? That's a great question. That's a great question for a community to think about. Why do we need institutions? You know, you can go into those whys. Why do we even have institutions? Maybe we needed them before we had the internet. Maybe we needed them during the industrial era. Maybe they were relevant then. Are they relevant today? You start to ask that question, you don't even, you know, a lot of things are possible today. Like all these big real estate buildings and all those big, you know, firms in New York City, literally, they could never be occupied again. We literally have that chance. What's easier? Is it easier to boot up that again and have everybody take the train and all this stuff? Or is it easier just to spend like a lot of infrastructure dollars on technology so you don't have to do that again? Like, these are choices. These are choices that are out there. If those big buildings are not reoccupied, then inner city life will be, the rents would be much lower. The opportunity for let's say, Black or minority business would be larger. There could be a revitalization. There's so much possibility in making just that one choice, you know? And of course, I'm not saying one person should make that choice. but maybe there's many, many executives that are making that choice. And that's kind of an interesting place to be standing. Now it's going to come with disruption, and disruption causes this energy and just some winners and losers before. But it's at least, you know, kind of an interesting experiment.
Yeah, one of the things I've noticed with COVID is the kind of anticipation of being out of work and being at home all the time, and kind of the idea of like that isolation and closing in of the world. And then as things kind of go back to normal, at least in British Columbia, because they've been able to flatten the curve quite a lot, so they're unlocking a lot. I've noticed family and friends going back to work and back to the old way. That's worse than the lockdown was, because they've had this exposure of like more of an open schedule and more autonomy.
Time to reflect, time to reconnect with family.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a good point, because, you know, a lot of people do that. Like, it's once you've been, if you've had your career and you've been out of like your career for a long time, and then, oh, you go back, now you can't see it the way you saw it before. Now, like, you start to see what it really is, you know, like that little movie that's been playing in your head, like, oh, I've got a big desk and like I'm doing important work. It's not there anymore. And you just like walk in and you're like, this is fucking crazy. Like, this is like fucking crazy. And you look at how you use your time, and it's just, I mean, one of the reasons why there's so much drama in the workplace, people are bored.
Yeah.
You know, so then there's this natural arising of energy to go and poke at someone or to fuck with someone. And then that gets like, and then you got your deadlines, and then it actually is a way for the human system to create meaning inside the workplace. And if you have the good fortune one day of noticing that when you walk into work, it's like being on drugs. You're like, what the hell? You know, like, you can't make any meaning out of what's going on anymore, because you're not running that fantasy in your head.
Yeah, I know that in myself for sure. And it's been funny watching Alex, our son, kind of like, he's still pretty young, but you can see him get bored and then start smashing things and getting more and more violent.
And that's also, you know, a component of the riots, you know, the energy has to go somewhere. And I like some of them, protest, in the right state of mind. You know, they started to sing and dance, and you see it kind of like releases the energy also, you know. It's not appropriate in every situation. But some of them have turned into almost like people just want to be out there with other people or something, you know.
As if this lockdown and isolation is making us want to get out of the house.
I don't know. And then, of course, this is the exact way these complex systems work. So, you know, you have more people congregating in more less protected spaces faster than maybe would have happened before. We don't know. But it just shows you the fallacy of trying to control these things the way we ordinarily have gone about things. And complex adaptive systems thinking, I tell my, when I coach managers, I'm like, never try to strategize your employees, because they're smart too. So, you know, you try to strategize them and then it goes underground, you get all these other games and this and that. So this is why complex adaptive thinking always escalates complexity. You know, so the viruses are a perfect example. You know, we adapt to them by vaccinating, and then they're gonna get more complex, and then this, and pesticides, same thing. The Darwinian attitude is in the way we frame complexity and in our response. And the question is, can we come up with an understanding of systems that doesn't lead us to that response. It doesn't escalate the complexity. Now, this is a hole in our toolkit. I don't know of one, but I think that's it's interesting, kind of being open to that.
All right, that was it for Bonita Roy back on Future Thinkers. You can find all the links and show notes at futurethinkers.org/125. And to get the full 90-minute interview, become a member at futurethinkers.org/members. And to see our first interview with Bonita, go to futurethinkers.org/119. See you soon.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month, we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.